So I thought I would start us off with an actual case. So I'm going to take 10 minutes and talk you through how to go about briefing a case, and then I'll turn the microphone over to Professor Coughlin. But we're also going to have plenty of time at the end for you guys to ask questions. So for this, you do need that handout that Pam's just taking to the back, but it also got passed around. It's this little one-page handout that shows you the case of Lucy versus Zimmer. So has case yet? If you have, all right, okay, good. So people are familiar with this case from contracts class. All right, so you guys know the story then. This is a case that is about this guy, Mr. Lucy, who wants to buy a farm, and Mr. Zimmer, who doesn't want to sell it. So it's Ferguson Farm. Here is the picture of Ferguson Farm, lovely place in Dinwiddie County, Virginia. And according to the facts of the case, if you read the case, here's what happens. You got Mr. Lucy, December 20th, 1952. Now, he's come to Mr. Zimmer multiple times before and said, really want to buy this farm, 471 acres. And Mr. Zimmer, again and again, has said, nah, I'm not going to sell this to you. So on this fateful day, Mr. Lucy comes into this restaurant, Ye Olde Virginie, which is owned by Mr. Zimmer. A bottle of whiskey in his hand, and these two start drinking. So Mr. Zimmer testifies that he's high as a Georgia pine, and a waitress testifies that the men were drinking right much. So then a conversation ensues, and the conversation could or could not sound like it was in jest. So what happens is Lucy says, I bet you wouldn't take $50,000 for that place. And Mr. Zimmer says, yes, I would too. You wouldn't give $50. So after this exchange, a contract for sale, they write it out on this bar tab. So this informal looking thing, except it says pretty explicitly what's going on. We hereby agree to sell to W.O. Lucy the Ferguson Farm, complete, for $50,000, title satisfactory to buyer. And then look at this at the bottom. Mr. Zimmer has signed it, but not only that, he gets his wife to sign it. So Mr. Zimmer, apparently, he testifies that he whispered to his wife, it's all a joke. So she says, all right, so she signs the thing too. So Mr. Lucy then, hot dog, he's got his farm, and he wants Mr. Zimmer to turn it over. And Mr. Zimmer says, wait a minute, this was all a joke. So that is the issue in this case. Does Mr. Zimmer have to turn the land over to Mr. Lucy? All right, so if you read the case, you would want to be taking notes about these things. So the first page of the handout that I've given you is a sample of how you could be highlighting and identifying for yourself the items in the case that are likely to come up when you are on call. So for this, what I'm suggesting is that you come up with a system. Now, it doesn't have to be my system. This was my system. I liked lots of colorful highlighting, and I liked big words in block letters out in the margins, and that was because that was helping me quickly identify the important stuff. So that's what I'm showing you here. So I had, anytime I had the parties, I'd circle the parties, and then out to the side, I'd write plaintiff and defendant. And by the way, I loved those little symbols, so you may have seen these. Defendant is usually abbreviated as a triangle, and plaintiff is a little pie, like a little sign like that. Or you could just write out plaintiff and defendant, however you want to do it. And then you want to start sorting out the facts. So the facts were showing up sort of in the order in which they were described in testimony, but some of them help Lucy and some of them help Zimmer, and then they're all mixed together. So it could be useful in a case like this to take different color highlighters. So the facts that help Lucy, it's really helpful to Lucy that he's got this written document that Zimmer wrote, and that it's on its face, it looks pretty clear what has transpired here, and that Zimmer's wife signed the thing too. So those are three facts that are highlighted in green because those are really helpful to Lucy. Facts are helpful to Zimmer. He thought it was a joke. Lucy and he both had a couple of drinks before they signed the thing. He didn't take the $5 cash that was offered on that day in order to seal the bargain. And Zimmer assured him on that day that he had no intention of selling the farm. He really thought the whole thing was a joke. So the idea is, if you had highlighted those different facts in these different colors, and then you got called on, and the professor said, how would you argue this case if you were representing Mr. Zimmer? Then you could pull the facts that are useful to Mr. Zimmer? Or how would you argue this case if you were representing Mr. Lucy? You could pull those facts out as well. So that's what I think. And then as the case goes on, you'd underline what the conclusion is. You can see up here in the first paragraph, I've underlined what the issue is. Okay, so the issue, the way the court says it, is to have specific performance of a contract by which it was alleged the Zimmers had sold to W.O. Lucy a tract of land owned by A.H. Zimmer. So that's just gobbledygook right there. That's the kind of language that would freak me out as a law student if I got called on and I had to quickly translate that in my head. So that's why, in addition to underlining important stuff in my casebook, I also encourage you to try and make a case brief. So the case brief is the second page of your handout. So this is my little sample case brief. And what this is giving you is the template that I used to use when I was creating case briefs. So my goal was one page per case. I wanted to do that because I was really trying to force myself to pull out the important stuff. And you'll notice also with the highlighting, I was only highlighting the really important stuff. Because if I read it through and highlighted everything, then it was going to be too messy. So sometimes, especially when I was starting out, I'd read the case through once without highlighting anything to try to get what was going on. And then I'd go back and do the highlighting the second time around. Because otherwise, if I just had the pen in my hand as I was reading it through the first time, the whole thing would be underlined. All right, so the case brief. So here is essentially what is on that second page of the handout. You can see with the issue, so first I've written the parties, and I've written in parentheses, which is the one who wants to buy the farm and which is the one who wants to sell the farm, or doesn't want to sell the farm. Because with just plaintiff and defendant, that can just get balled up in your head, trying to remember which is the one who actually sued the other one. And that's kind of not so important for your class discussion. What's important is, what do these people want? So a little parenthetical that tells you. Useful. And then issue, so I translated it. So the way I was describing the issue, does Zimmer have to hand over that farm if he thought the deal was a joke, but he acted as if it wasn't? There's your issue. And then if you had to put it in more legalese, that's what I put in parentheses, is a party bound if he acts as if he assents to an agreement, even if he didn't really mean it. So I got that there so that it's still a little more straightforward than the actual language in the old-timey case. But if I wanted to sound a little more buttoned up as I'm talking to the professor, I could describe it in this way. All right, so then the next section is those facts where I'm divvying them up. So which are the ones that help Zimmer, and then which are the ones that help Lucy. All right, and then the next section is holding. So what does this case say? Zimmer acted like he wanted to sell, so it kind of doesn't matter what he was thinking. The court says Zimmer's got to convey the farm to Lucy. And then the final section of this case brief is, I think, the most important, which is why. Why this holding? And you could also put in a section about what is the problem with this holding. So why this holding? Well, you have this plain-looking contract. An offer, there was acceptance, there was execution, there was delivery of the written contract. If you had a different rule that said you could get out of any old contract by saying, whoops, I didn't mean it, then it would mean that all contracts are unenforceable. So we really don't want to be digging underneath a contract if it looks okay on its face. That's why you have a rule like this. Now, if I wanted to add an additional paragraph, and I didn't do it because I wanted to give you the sample page, but if I wanted one more paragraph, I could put in one that would be, what would be the best argument on the other side? And so the best argument on the other side, you really could argue that Lucy knew full well that Zimmer didn't mean it, because Lucy is the one who brought in the whiskey. Lucy is the one who was encouraging Zimmer to drink. So you could say maybe Zimmer wasn't even in his right mind when this was happening. If he was high as a Georgia pine and that waitress says they'd been drinking right much and it was Lucy who made that happen, then maybe he's not actually in a position to execute a contract. So this is something else you guys will be looking at in contracts cases. Is there something like that going on that makes the parties not able to actually be bound by a contract? That'd probably be your best argument on the other side. So if you're the lawyer for Zimmer, you'd really want to be focusing on the whiskey and Lucy, the fact that Lucy brought in the whiskey. That's it. So that's how this case would fit into sort of a bigger discussion of contracts. And if you had this, then that's going to let you play with it. So if your professor says, all right, we're going to change the facts and we're going to say there was no whiskey, okay, there's no whiskey, then Zimmer really does have to turn the farm over. If there was so much whiskey that Zimmer then passed out and Lucy stood over him rubbing his hands gleefully saying, ah, I'm so glad that happened, now I definitely get this farm. You know, you could think about how could you take these different facts and bring them to the extreme, and that's going to help you figure out how you would argue this case. All right, so that is just a sample of the sort of thing that you can do, but that discipline of doing the underlining and then creating the case brief, done that once, then you've underlined, then you created the case brief. You've gone through that case three times, and so that means you're going to know it. So then if people are asking you questions about it, you're going to be fine. You're going to be able to answer those questions. All right, let me turn the mic over to Professor Coughlin for her 2 cents about this, and then we can answer questions from you.
It's really great to see all of you here, and I want to start by thanking Pam for instituting this series. It's the first time we've had a session like this in my recollection, and I feel like I've been here forever. And I think it's a really terrific thing. I'm going to make some specific comments to follow on Professor Schadl's suggestions, but I'm also going to step back and say a few broader things first. One reason why I'm delighted to be here is that it gives me the opportunity to tell you how important I think it is for you to be briefing your cases. I just think there is no substitute for doing this sort of careful preparation and starting it from the very beginning of law school. And here's why. The best lawyers that you will ever meet are doing some version of this for their entire career. No one goes into court, no one goes into a big transaction, no one comes and stands before this podium without having done a ton of reading and briefing and outlining and thinking. So that's something, you know, it's just absolutely the work of lawyering, and you want to be active about it, and the briefing gets you active from the very first step. So that's one thing that I want to say to you. Students will frequently ask, just as I did, oh, do I really have to do this? It's so difficult at first. It is. It's difficult. And it feels a little tedious, too, right? You've just read for 3 hours. You don't know what the heck you read. And now you're expected to boil it down to a page or page and a half. But yeah, start doing it. Take a shot at it. Here's a metaphor for you. Someone asked me during the welcome picnic if I thought it was a good idea to grab commercial outlines, commercial briefs, or what about briefs that were prepared by a student who was successful in my class? And my reaction was, no, they're not going to help you. But then I kind of sort of softened it a little bit because it's the welcome picnic and I'm trying to be, you know, I'm trying to be pleasant and I'm trying to say, oh yeah, you can, you know, use some smart person's briefs. But using someone else's briefs is like buying a bottle of that stuff called jogging in a jug instead of jogging yourself. So every time I am running on my treadmill, I turn it on in the morning and there's always an ad for jogging in a jug. And I would love to tell you that you can just go and buy briefs in a jug or jogging in a jug and gulp it down. You can't. You cannot exercise your brain the way lawyers exercise their brains by reading someone else's summary. You gotta learn how to summarize yourself. Okay? So that's the thing. I wish it was otherwise, just as every day I wish, boy, jogging in a jug. There I go. You have to do it yourself. So that's the first thing. And I really appreciate having the opportunity to tell you this because some wise person told me this when I was on the verge of going to law school. And I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, but I got that one right. I paid attention to the person and I went ahead and I briefed cases. So I'm going to try to make a couple of additional comments about how the briefs help you out on a day-to-day basis and then moving forward. But the most important thing that you're learning to do, you're learning the building block of lawyering, or at least one of the building blocks of lawyering in a common law system, in a system where judges make law and that law is embedded in a case. You're learning how to read cases and quickly or slowly, some cases are harder than others, identify what is the rule in the case. How did the judge resolve the issue, articulate it in a holding or a rule, and then what was the rationale for doing so? This is lawmaking, and you've got to participate in understanding how to translate, how to dissect quickly and accurately what's going on in a case. Now, when I say accurately, of course, one of the reasons why we get paid our salaries is that law mutates, law changes. So you might accurately describe one day and then have to take account of subsequent developments. But that's what you're learning to do. You're learning the building blocks, or one of the building blocks, of being a lawyer. And as I said, there's just no substitute to doing it yourself. I want to add a couple of things to what Molly said and then say a little bit more. I would also add who wins. Sometimes when I was a law student, it was very hard to tell who it was that won. And it's just nice to have this sort of bottom line when you were going through this, you know, list, you know, holding and so forth. It's a really good thing to have just, you know, parties, facts, parties, issues presented, who wins, and then obviously the holding and so forth. The other thing that I would add if I were you is the procedural posture of the case. At least in some classes, the procedural posture of the case is going to be really important. And I know in criminal law, it's something that I routinely ask students. And I don't ask it just to make additional work for you, but in part to help you learn what court procedures are. You know, it's one of those osmosis things. But also because the procedural posture frequently, if not always, places a constraint on the way that judges can rule. So obviously, if you're in a trial and you're in the process of finding and creating facts and ruling in the first instance, everything's de novo. Right? But then as you go up the ladder on appeal, there are rules of appellate review that confine what the appellate judges can do. And that's a frequently an important piece of at least my course, and I suspect it's an important piece of others. So I would add the procedural posture, because frequently the courts mention it and you need to learn that stuff. But also, more to the point, it really affects the bottom line rationale. Sometimes the appellate judges, they may think, gee, you know, I think that so-and-so really should have won, but the jury ruled the other way, and given the rules of appellate procedure, I don't have the ability to rule in their favor. So you'll want to remark those kinds of things as well. The other thing that I would mention to you, and I was trying to think about how much I struggled when I was a student with briefs, and you're going to struggle at first, I think. And so don't be upset with yourself that you're struggling. The struggle, as I said, it's the point. It's the jogging. It's whatever your CrossFit metaphor is, or playing an instrument. You know, whatever it is, the metaphor for you, you know, you need to go through that sweat, if you will, in order for your brain to start working in the way that lawyers, the best lawyers, do. So you don't want to reproduce the entire case, right? Now, the students who are taking crim with me know that on tomorrow, is our class tomorrow? On Tuesday, we are reading a case called Martin, which mercifully is about four sentences, you know, or 12 sentences. So you can reproduce that whole thing in your brief. But sometimes you'll have a case that's much, much longer than that, so it requires some careful selection. And that can be quite intimidating in the beginning. So what I would do, if you find yourself beating your head against your brief for, you know, 2 or 3 hours, no. I mean, 2 or 3 hours in addition to the reading. Once you've done your reading, I would give myself a sensible time limit in the beginning, 30 minutes, say, for briefing a case. And at the end of the 30 minutes, just wrap it up, come along to class, and we'll sort it, if you see what I mean. Don't lose sleep over trying to get the perfect brief in the beginning. There is no such thing as a perfect brief. These are human products, and I think it's a good idea to give yourself some kind of time limit. Certainly that's something that I had to do, since I was having so much trouble with it. The other thing on that same score is that you will want to revise your briefs in light of what you learned in class, because frequently the professor will give you additional reasons for, particularly under the rationale for the holding, the rationale for the ruling. So in other words, you absolutely want to be reading these cases in order to identify the doctrine, okay? So think of that as your homework. Your professor has asked you to read this case. They're expecting you to be able to brief it with a particular eye to pulling out the doctrine. Then you come along to class and you can kind of sort of see how it went. But at the end of the day, or part of the discussion, the professor is also going to be giving you his or her, and hopefully it's not idiosyncratic, they're going to be giving you his or her rationale. Here's why the court ruled this way. Maybe it's a law and econ, an inefficiency argument. Maybe it's some historical explanation. And these are frequently things that you as students can't instantly grasp from the surface of the text, because it may not be there. So what you'll want to do under the rationale part is to write down what the court said. Here's why, here's the policy reasons or rationale the court invoked for why this is a good rule. But then you'll also want to notice what your professor said and add it to the brief at some point. Presumably when it's fresh on your mind is a good time to do it. I guess I'm just going to say a couple of additional things and then we'll open it up for your questions. I hope and believe that there's a very direct relationship between the briefing you do and the work that you do in class. I try to approach my classes knowing that the only thing we have in common, apart from our basic humanity, is that text. You know I've read it, I know you've read it. So that's the thing we share in common coming into class. As the semester progresses, we'll learn a lot more about each other. We'll learn, some of you are philosophers, some of you are, I'm not gonna go off on that, but anyway, you get my point. We'll learn a lot more about each other. And so I'll know what some of your priors are, you'll know some of mine, we'll get a shared vocabulary for this collaborative thing we call the class. But our job together is to come to some kind of meeting of the mind with respect to that text. So when you come to class, you want to have given it your best shot. And notice, behind the podium, your professor has done the same thing. So we have these elaborate outlines, either on paper or in our heads or both, where we're conveying to you, in effect, our brief of the case and helping you understand how we arrived at it and so forth. So it's a great thing to come along to class having done the brief yourself. You haven't just read someone else's description, you've actually tried to do the work. It's going to make it a lot easier not just to follow the discussion, but to take the additional steps your professor's going to have in mind when they start giving you hypotheticals and so forth. The other thing, of course, is that there's a very direct link between briefs, exam outlines, and exams. If you get very disciplined about the practice of doing good briefs, you know, giving it your best shot before you come in, you get to class and you discover, oh my goodness, the professor's talking about something totally different, go home and revise your brief. When it comes time to do your outline, you've got this great collection of notes that you've been updating throughout the semester that you can just turn to quickly translate into what we call the exam outline. So it's really, really useful and very important work. And again, commercial outlines, outlines from smart people that took the class, they're helpful. They can be an adjunct to your learning, particularly if there are places where the professor has been unclear, but it's no substitute for doing it yourself. But last, I want to circle back around to where I started. You know, we talk about briefs, and what we're describing here are these brief summaries of cases. You're doing case briefs. You're not writing a brief to a court. But the case briefs, as I mentioned before, are the building blocks for the argumentative briefs that lawyers file in court. Underneath those argumentative briefs, and they're filed in every courtroom everywhere in the country every day, those lawyers have briefed those cases. Now they're more sophisticated than hopefully you'll down the road you'll be able to do it differently. Ditto with judicial opinions. So for those of you who clerk and write opinions for your judges, you're darned right. You have to very carefully, in effect, brief all of the cases that you're going to be citing. And by brief, I just mean you have to be able to dissect them, to understand what the ruling was, to figure out how to distinguish them, and so forth. So when I was a law clerk, I would find myself briefing on little flashcards. You know what? Word processing wasn't in existence during my first clerkship. So we had electric typewriters, which we thought were really cool. So I actually use little flashcards. I don't know what you all use anymore. I haven't learned. But my point is simply, there I am clerking, and I'm going back to that basic thing that you're now starting to learn to do. And it's because I'd learned to do it that I was able to write an opinion that my judge at least didn't fire me, you know. So again, that's why this is our plea to you. We're not making work for you. We're not making busy work, okay? We clearly are making work. But we're not making busy work. What we're trying to do is to introduce you to the work of lawyering, the fundamental work of lawyering. And so that's why we're so glad to see you all here today.